Adam Haneya is a professor at the University of Exeter, where he focuses on political economy and specifically the political economy of the Gulf oil states. And increasingly, it seems, and we'll ask you about this, it seems like your work has focused on the growing connection between the Gulf Arab states and East Asia, and the growing connections between their oil economies and their economies in general. So that's definitely a huge part of what we're interested in hearing about. And maybe we can start with just since COP28 is happening right now, I'm really interested to know your sort of overall take or framework of looking at why COP28 is so important for the UAE and where that fits into your analysis. Because more than most people on Earth, I think you've really taken like a big view of what's going on with these political economies in the Gulf. So it's fascinating for us to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, thanks very much for the opportunity to talk to you today. I really do think that COP28 is a very clear indication of the centrality of the Gulf states, especially the UAE and Saudi Arabia, in both the global oil economy, but also in increasingly steering the direction of the world's response to climate change. And I think this it's useful perhaps to step back and look at COP27, which was held in Egypt last year. And in that event, which also the Gulf states played a major role, I think, in steering the discussions in COP27, the largest national pavilion in COP27 was Saudi Arabia, and that was then followed by the UAE, Qatar, and Bahrain in terms of the size of their national pavilions. In fact, the Saudi pavilion, I think, in COP27 was exactly double the area of the pavilion housing the whole continent of Africa, you know, a part of the world which is you know, going to be most directly under threat from the effects of climate change. So I think what that shows is that COP27, and I think we can say the same thing about COP28, is really nothing more than an exhibition space for the world's largest oil and gas producers, in this case led by the Gulf states. So the impact of this in terms of the COP27, I think, was felt in terms of the final resolution, where the language around phasing out fossil fuels was defeated by an alliance led by Saudi Arabia, in alliance with the military government in Egypt, also backed by Saudi Arabia, who hosted the event. And indeed, COP27, quite bizarrely, the final text of the COP27 carried no mention of oil, which I think is quite striking, given what the meeting is supposed to be about. So I think, given the fact that you know, these COP events are really little more than events designed to allow the world's largest polluters to enact their planet-saving performances, I think it's actually quite appropriate that it's taking place in the UAE under the presidency of Sultan Ahmed Al Jaber, the CEO of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, or ADNOC, one of the world's largest oil companies. So, you know, I really don't think this is strange. I think it tells us a lot about what these meetings are designed to do.
Do you think the UAE was looking to get anything in particular out of hosting COP? Does that fit somewhere into their agenda?
Absolutely. I'm sure we'll get into talking about this in more detail, but I think we need to remember that the world's largest oil firms, you know, both the Western supermajors like ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and so forth, as well as national oil companies like the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, their business is selling oil. And they have no intention, and they've said this explicitly, of walking away from fossil fuels. Just last year, the Saudi oil minister was very explicit. He said every molecule of hydrocarbons will come out, to quote him directly. They have no intention of phasing out their production and sale of oil. We can see this in their actions. Saudi Aramco, the world's largest oil company, has invested more in the expansion of oil fields in 2022 than any other company in the world. They intend to increase oil production by more than 8% by 2027. So, you know, this is what's happening on one side is the kind of expansion of the oil industry, the expansion of their production, with no intention of walking away from fossil fuels. But at the same time, they are also, as I said, trying to position themselves as principal actors in steering the response to the climate emergency. And they're simultaneously moving into new markets around renewables and the various kinds of false solutions, I think, that are being offered are at hand, you know, such as carbon capture and hydrogen, those kinds of things, where again, the Gulf national oil companies have declared very publicly that they intend to lead the world in these kinds of technologies. So it's not a contradiction. It's about making money, whether it be in their primary business, which is oil, as well as these new markets that are opening up around renewables and green technologies. It's about making money at the expense of destroying the planet. I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of that, as you've probably seen, there's this company, Blue Carbon. It's gotten a lot of attention for the huge like bits of land that were bought up around Africa, various countries. I don't have them in front of me, but it's like Zambia, Kenya, several others, Zimbabwe, I think. So like, how does that fit into the UAE's strategy, or how does that, what does that tell us about what they're doing and how they're using their like surplus wealth to continue their oil business, or what does that look like for you?
Yeah. I mean, this is again, I think it relates to what I was just saying, is that there's no doubt on one side that they intend to keep the hydrocarbon economy going, fossil fuel production going, fossil fuel exports going. They're quite explicit about this. But at the same time, they're kind of embracing these other kinds of new green technologies and the language of low carbon, carbon trading, carbon capture. They're doing both at the same time. And this is not just the Gulf national oil companies. It's very much also the case with the Western supermajors doing the same kinds of things. Again, if we take Saudi Arabia, which is really key to all of this, because it is, you know, a key cog in the oil, global oil industry. They've announced a range of climate initiatives in the last few years, including the goal of producing half of the country's electricity from renewables by 2030. This is in Saudi Arabia, and this is faster than, you know, many other parts of the world, including the European Union. But they talk about this in the sense of allowing them to actually export more oil. They very explicitly say by reducing oil consumption in Saudi Arabia domestically, that will give them more that they can then export and sell to other parts of the world. So, you know, this kind of, again, there's no contradiction, I think, between this kind of expansion into these, you know, carbon trading, low carbon solutions, et cetera, and the continuation of oil production.
I should probably mention at some point. So one of the reasons that we wanted to reach out to you is because we read your chapter in the book that just came out, Dismantling Green Colonialism. And we'll put a link to that in the description. And what's interesting about that book in general is the way in which it shows you the way in which the global north is using some of these climate technologies and things to extract resources from the global south, or to rejig their energy transition in a way where they don't have to use their own land, their own resources. And so the Gulf has been, I guess, doing that in certain ways for years, right? Like their investments in like agriculture around Africa and the Middle East, so that they don't have the agricultural space to do this. So they're using their wealth to like offshore all of this and in a way extract like resources from these other countries. So, and that kind of feels like what we're seeing as well with Blue Carbon. I mean, how do you see that? Like, how do you see the Gulf's use of its wealth to kind of like move all these operations? I mean, to us, we joke about it. It looks like they're building a little empire out of their own little empire within an empire, like within the Western Empire and within maybe a rising China. They've now built this regional empire where they're buying up land in Africa. They're buying up agricultural space. Does that make sense to you, or how of us describing it that way? Or what does that look like for you? These like years of deals and various projects.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's very clear if you look, especially over the last 2 decades, this is not new, what we're seeing and the processes you're describing. If we look over the last 2 decades, Gulf investors, and this is both the kind of state institutions like sovereign wealth funds, Gulf sovereign wealth funds, but also private actors in the Gulf, big conglomerates, big business conglomerates, have expanded regionally throughout the Middle East and also into Africa, as you've mentioned. And this is, land is a big part of this, buying up land, partly to do with agricultural production, as you've said, but it's also into other sectors as well. If you look, for example, at finance and banking, if you look, for example, at telecommunications, if you look, for example, at real estate, if you look, for example, at industry, industrial production in places like Egypt and elsewhere, the Gulf investors have been major actors in this kind of, if you like, internationalization of capital. They're expanding regionally, and they're doing this in a sense to. It's about making money. It's about profits. But what it is doing is giving them a really deep role, both politically and economically, in the surrounding region. And this has, I think, become very evident since 2011, since the Arab uprisings, that we can see the way that the Gulf has become really intent on steering the outcome and the political economy of the wider region through their relationships with various governments in the Arab world. The other thing I would say about this, and I think this is really important, is that this expansion of Gulf capital in land and everywhere, all these other sectors, was closely correlated to kind of the neoliberal turn that took place in the Middle East through the 2000s. Basically, you know, when governments such as the Mubarak in Egypt privatized land, opened up the economy, encouraged foreign investment, that was the one side of this expansion of Gulf capitalists, what enabled and was fed by this expansion of Gulf investment. So there's a kind of a twinning on one side of this growth of the power of the Gulf, but also on the other with this liberalization of the regional economies in the Arab world. So I wouldn't describe this necessarily as imperialism, because I think there's significant differences between, you know, how we think about Western imperialism and what the Gulf is doing. But certainly the Gulf is really playing a major role in the political economy of the region. We can't understand what's going on in Egypt or Jordan or Lebanon without placing the Gulf centrally in this political economy.
I thought it was really fascinating in the chapter you discussed how the national oil companies have really displaced the Western majors in a lot of ways. As someone who doesn't follow the oil economy super closely, I wasn't aware the extent of that until I read that. Can you talk a little bit about that and like why that's so important for us to keep this in mind when we're looking at whether it's COP28 or just in general, just analyzing what's going on in the region?
Yeah, well, I'm sure, just to begin with the Western super majors, and we obviously have to keep them centrally in the picture when we're talking about oil. But I'm sure many of your listeners will remember the news headlines earlier this year when those Western super majors began reporting their financial results for 2022. You know, this is coming out of the COVID pandemic. Oil has been surging in price, through 2022. And as these super majors, you know, ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, BP, as they reported their profits, the five leading companies, in fact, reported a profit, I think, of around $200 billion. In profits for 2022. These are the Western companies. So this is basically, you know, $23 million, it works out to be, for every hour of 2022, were the Western oil company, top five Western oil company profits for 2022. Just a few months later, Saudi Aramco, a single national oil company, reported its 2022 profits, and it was $161 billion. So it's basically the Aramco results exceeded the profits from Shell, BP, ExxonMobil, and Chevron. It was the largest corporate profit recorded in any industry, any time in history. So, you know, these are this is one Gulf oil company. And I think this profit level is indicative of a shift that's taken place in the global oil industry over the last couple of decades. Basically, the rise of these large national oil companies run by governments in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, ADNOC, for example, Brazil, China, Russia, and elsewhere, that have really they've diversified. They're not simply producers of crude oil. In other words, they don't just extract oil from the ground in its crude form. They are also major refiners of oil, turning oil into useful products such as petrol, such as petrochemicals. They're involved in the transportation and the sale of oil to the consumer, and in many respects have overtaken the Western, privately owned Western supermajors in all these areas. So it's really important, I think, that we center much more the role of these national oil companies in the climate emergency. Again, I'm definitely not saying that we should let the Western supermajors off the hook. They remain major players, particularly in the North American context. But what we're seeing, if you like, is this fragmentation of the world oil market, where on one hand we have a North American bloc, where it's the big Western companies that are continuing to be the major players, the major extractors, the major retailers of oil and refiners. And on the other hand, a new kind of axis that's emerging between the Gulf states and China, East Asia, where there's a new kind of what I've called a East hydrocarbon axis that's emerging. So I think we can't ignore any kind of attempt to understand the climate crisis and what we must do about it. Cannot simply concentrate its fire on the Western companies. We need to think about these new the new kind of role of the oil of these national oil companies in the global oil industry.
It seems like it would be even harder to have like some kind of like, I don't know what it would be called, activism or whatever you would want to do against these companies, I suppose, since they're in places like the UAE and Saudi Arabia where there's not much activism anyway. Is that part of what's so complicated, or what do you think is like the impact of having to direct some of this against the NOCs?
I mean, I think that's true. And I think that goes back to one of your earlier questions around why is COP held in the UAE? Where it is very difficult to engage in any kind of public protest or mobilization. Why is it held in Egypt, COP27? I mean, I think that's also indicative. But I do think we need to think of these oil companies as global oil companies. They're not simply active in their national states. The biggest oil refinery in the United States, for example, is actually owned by Saudi Aramco. It's not an American oil firm. It's not to say that overall Saudi Aramco is the biggest oil refiner in the US, but the biggest physical plant is actually owned by Saudi Aramco. They also have plants in the UK, Europe, refineries and the sale of oil. So I do think it's about taking a global perspective on how oil works. And thinking about the kind of chain, if you like, of oil from its extraction through its refining, through how it's transported and sold to the final consumer. So I do think it's possible to think about campaigning around oil in that global sense.
That's interesting. Yeah. Mm. The other aspect of this of your work is this growing connection between the national oil companies and East Asia. How has that developed? What's the importance of that?
Yeah, it's perhaps necessary to step back a little bit here and to think about what happened globally in oil from the early 2000s, basically from about 2000 to 2019, there was a major increase in global oil consumption. About 30% was the annual increase in annual global oil consumption in between 2000 and 2019, which really is on one hand quite shocking. Given that we're talking about the need to reduce oil consumption, but this 30% increase in oil, global oil consumption was in large part due to China's booming demand for hydrocarbons, for oil, gas, and also refined products like petrochemicals. Reason, it wasn't the only reason, but it was one reason why there was a surge in oil prices through the first two decades of the new millennium. Oil peaked at about $147 per barrel in 2008. Then we had the 2008 global economic crisis. The oil price fell, but then it went back up, peaking again in about mid-2014. And you know, we can talk about what happened after the pandemic, and now oil prices have gone up again in more recently since the pandemic. But this kind of prolonged period of quite high oil prices was really a financial boon for the major oil exporters in the Gulf. They accumulated trillions of dollars in financial surpluses through the sale of oil. And one of the things that this did is connected to what we talked about earlier in terms of where these, you know, where these surpluses ended up going, partly into the regional economy in the Arab world, but also into the hydrocarbon economies in China and East Asia. So the Gulf's exports of oil shifted eastward, exports of crude oil, but also there was a significant increase in cross-regional investments between the Gulf states and East Asia into things like refineries, into petrochemical plants, into plastics production, into the transport and sale of oil through the entire East Asian region. So China's part of this, but also South Korea, Malaysia, Japan, and other parts of Asia. So I think it's really important to think about these kinds of interdependencies now that have formed between the Gulf and East Asia that go far beyond just simply the export of oil. They really are about the control of hydrocarbon infrastructure in the region. And there's also, importantly, to understand a reverse kind of flow of investments from China and East Asia into the Gulf, into oil fields, into partnerships with ADNOC, for example, as the company I mentioned earlier in Abu Dhabi. So you know, it's I think really kind of unpacking these interregional connections is important in terms of understanding what's going on in oil today. Again, to emphasize, this is not to let Western supermajors off the hook, but to understand how these kind of regional interdependencies, regional blocks are forming in the oil industry.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
When we did a podcast with Hamza Hamoshain recently, and he mentions, you know, blue carbon and the UAE buying up land and all that, we got all these comments on TikTok. People from there, like, you know, attacking us. Oh, so what's wrong with that? It's just business. You guys should learn how to do it as well. Like, you know, and so that's that brings me to my question. Like why is this like dangerous? Like, what should we be worried about?
Well, I think that, I mean, the big problem is the, you know, unequivocal scientific conclusion that we need to stop fossil fuel production. We need to stop fossil fuel extraction if we are going to have any chance of meeting, you know, the Paris targets around climate change, which is what COP is intended to deal with. So, you know, how are we going to do that if these large oil companies are actually seeing their position strengthened, both in fossil fuel production, as well as, and partly through their involvement in renewables and other kinds of green technologies. I should say these green technologies, you might have discussed this with Hamza and others, things such as the hydrogen, blue hydrogen, or the kind of focus on carbon capture. These are false solutions. And I think it's very convincing a case can be made around that, that the actual thing that needs to be done is to move away from fossil fuel centered economies. That's not going to be possible if this is going to be a process led by the largest oil companies in the world. It's not going to happen. So that's why I would say that your listeners really need to be concerned about this. This is not something that can be dealt with by just putting our heads in the sand and talking about business as usual.
Yeah, actually, we did the podcasts with Hamza in Arabic, and a lot of our listeners either they'll understand English or Arabic, maybe not both. So maybe they haven't heard that one. Why do you think these are false solutions? Like, what would be your take on why those green technologies are not necessarily, not the green technologies always, but like the carbon trading or the blue hydrogen or the green hydrogen? Like, what would you mean by false solutions?
Well, I think, for example, let's take hydrogen. The production of hydrogen, they've named them with different colors, but blue hydrogen is basically consumes enormous amounts of natural gas, which is a major greenhouse gas. It's a fossil fuel. I think the evidence is very clear that hydrogen is basically being promoted so heavily by the oil industry because it allows the continued consumption of gas, natural gas, which is very, very dangerous because gas is not just a carbon emitter, it's also a methane emitter. A lot of methane, a very potent greenhouse gas, is emitted in the production of gas in the natural gas industry as well. So this is why I call it a false solution. This is not me that's saying this. I think there's plenty of energy experts, climate experts who will take exactly the same position. It's interesting to note that the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, for example, has explicitly said they want to be leaders in hydrogen, global leaders in hydrogen. I think the first shipment, actually, maritime shipment of blue hydrogen, this hydrogen that's so connected to green, the gas industry, was made, I think, early this year to South Korea. It was a Saudi shipment of this blue hydrogen. So again, it indicates that this hydrocarbon axis between both the Gulf and East Asia. Carbon capture is another, I think, example of these false solutions, in the sense that basically there's no scalable evidence that carbon can be captured at the levels that are needed to allow fossil fuel production to continue. This is a technology that was pioneered by the oil companies, and it was actually pioneered to increase the levels of their oil production by injecting carbon underground as part of extracting more oil. So the largest carbon capture plant is owned by ExxonMobil globally. So again, you know, when we're talking about these solutions that get bandied about as ways of dealing with fossil fuels, the problem is that they actually are not talking about reducing fossil fuel consumption. They're actually talking about increasing fossil fuel production, but trying to introduce these so-called technologies as a means of allowing that to happen.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The part that Hamza was more focused on is the way in which a lot of this renewable energy that's going to be built in order to in places like Egypt and elsewhere, is actually going to be used just to export the energy to Europe. So the renewable energy will never actually be used by places like Egypt. And there's quite a lot of emphasis right now these days in Egypt on these green hydrogen projects. But mostly it seems to be, I guess it's for electricity production in Europe. So what you said is actually quite interesting addition to that. So thanks.
I mean, you told us a bit about the environmental dangers of this continuous oil expansion by the Gulf, despite the very obvious threats. But can you tell us why it's also dangerous, like on a political level, for this? The more they expand their operations, the more money they make, and the more money they make, the more they can buy up things in neighboring countries, and then the more they do, the more political control they have. Like, and we've seen that play out, not too long ago in Egypt with UAE political interference. So how do you see that? How do you see that becoming worse potentially? What's the dangers of that?
Well, I think it's clear, again, looking at the region, the Arab world since 2011, and the Arab uprisings that began in Tunisia and then Egypt and spread across the whole region. I think thinking about those uprisings, we need to see them as being not simply about the question of, democracy, as they were kind of portrayed in much of the Western coverage about the uprisings, but actually very deeply connected to the liberalization and the neoliberal turn that happened in the region. From beginning in the mid 1980s through the 1990s and really accelerating in the 2000s, Mubarak, Ben Ali in Tunisia were, these rulers were really deeply connected to this neoliberal turn. They were the ones that drove forward the opening up of markets, the privatization process, the sale of land, the sale of assets. They did this in fully supported. By international financial institutions like the World Bank. And they did this with an increasingly authoritarian turn. This is the key point, is that in these states, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Morocco, in Jordan, neoliberalism was twinned with increasingly authoritarian states, authoritarian governments. And it makes sense, because you're making these measures that is leading to a polarization of wealth, increased inequalities. You need a state that's going to clamp down and prevent protests, prevent social movements against these measures. And so I think what we see here is that, and I'm coming to the question now of why what's the Gulf's role in all of this, is the Gulf has played a major role in supporting these authoritarian states and supporting this authoritarian turn in the region. And Egypt is the perfect example, I would say, of this. Saudi Arabia and the UAE, again, in particular, we can see this. So the danger is not just a matter of, where the wealth ends up, and what happens to, living standards, what happens to poverty levels, what happens to inequality levels. It's also about the kinds of states, the kinds of authoritarian and deeply stifling states that have been established over the region as part of this kind of realignment with the Gulf.
Yeah, the problem now is that whenever Egypt is in crisis, they have to turn to the Gulf as sort of like the lender of last resort, or now the buyer of assets of last resort. So they helped enable these conditions, and now they're benefiting from them. And now it seems like Egypt has no other choice but to sell off as many assets as possible to the Gulf. So this is like the tragedy that we're living through right now.
this is not, it's not new, you know, it's like you can track this, you know, for at least two decades. In the case of Egypt, you can see very clearly how, if you look at real estate, you look at banking, you look at, you know, the various kinds of sale, land sales, agribusiness, you know, the deep connections with the Gulf that's occurred under Mubarak.
Did the Gulf like economic model come from somewhere? Like, since you've studied this, is it based on a certain ideology or a certain model, or is it just the natural like outgrowth of having a huge oil surplus?
I mean, there is obviously that there were these you know, financial surpluses that really developed through the 2000s associated with this big increase in the price of oil. That accumulated the trillions of dollars in petrodollar surpluses that accumulated in the Gulf. But at the same time, in terms of the actual, you know, the liberalization that took place in the region, I think, as I said earlier, this was very much part of the kind of structural adjustment that began in the mid-1980s, globally, not just in the Middle East, but globally. You know, led by or promoted and pushed by international financial institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, Western governments. They were the ones that kind of encouraged this kind of economic model in countries like Egypt.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, there's always a sense of like when Western companies are buying up things in Egypt, there's always a sense of like, you know, we wish we didn't have to like sell them our stuff. But like, you know, as an Egyptian, like there's always a bit of like, it's okay, I guess, like if we have to, like it's all right if the Gulfies do it. Like, you know what I mean? It's like there's this like weird like sense of like, oh, you can trust them a little more because they're Arab. Maybe they won't like, you know, I don't know what the word is, screw us as badly as, you know, white people would. So that's just like, I mean, that's just the general sentiment, you know, like just street sentiment in Egypt, you know, on the buying up of assets by the Gulf. What do you think about that? I mean, capitalism is capitalism, right? What do you think?
Yes, I agree. I don't think there's any kind of difference, if you like, between who is doing it. And I think it's, you know, let's remember the Middle East is the most unequal region in the world. Levels of inequality in the Middle East are the most unequal in the world. And this is at a regional level. And the reason for that is because of this massive difference between the Gulf and the rest of the region. So, you know, you look at levels of poverty, levels of inequality that have deepened as these assets have been sold off, as, you know, local elites have benefited, as well as the regional elites, such as those in the Gulf. So I do think it's important to kind of think about these are processes that lead to inequality and different, you know, levels of power regionally and nationally. And it doesn't make a difference if it's a Western firm or a Gulf-based firm.
Yeah. One last thing about this whole Gulf hydrocarbon economy and trade between Asia and the Gulf. We've been seeing, of course, that they're looking to trade less in dollars. How does that play into the growing, like, relations between them? Is that just also kind of like what we'd expect to see happening as the relationship deepens? They would de-dollarize. Do you see any other impacts or significance of that?
Yeah, this is a really important question, and it's one that I think needs to be treated carefully, in the sense that oil has, since the post-war period, and certainly since the 1970s, the pricing of oil in US dollars, which kind of developed through the 1970s as solely being priced in US dollars, was really a key element to US dollar hegemony at a global level. And there's a long story to this, but the key point is that this relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia in particular, and the wider Gulf, was key to getting oil priced solely in US dollars. Before the 1970s, there was a significant portion of oil that was traded in British sterling, the British currency. But after the 1970s, it was US dollar became the key currency, and this was a big part of how the US dollar became what it is today. The fact that every country in the world, you basically have to hold dollars if you want to buy the most important commodity in the world, oil. So you know, this is a big thing. And through the oil pricing centered on the US dollars, after the kind of late 1980s, the way that this oil price was set was not by OPEC. It wasn't by the big Western companies. It actually is through the trade of oil, or trade of oil derivatives in two key financial markets. One is called WTI, West Texas Intermediate Oil, which is in the United States, and the other one is Brent, Brent oil, which is in Europe. Both of which are priced in dollars, and these are financial markets that where oil is barrels of oil are traded, derivatives are traded, and this is where the price of oil gets set daily. Now, what has happened in the last basically 10 years or so? China has moved towards attempting to establish a new oil pricing system. So in 2012, the Shanghai International Exchange announced a plan to develop an oil futures contract that was would be different from WTI and Brent, and it would be denominated in Chinese renminbi, the Chinese currency, RMB. And this would mark the first time since oil was traded in British sterling that it would be traded in a currency other than the US dollar. And this kind of oil futures contract was eventually launched in early 2018. So, you know, this is it's quite a big step, if you like. It's meant, and people have speculated, this is part of the shift towards decentering or de-dollarizing the global economy. If oil producing states such as Saudi Arabia begin to sell some of their oil in RMB, that means that they're going to be accumulating surpluses in the Chinese currency as well, and these could be used to encourage, you know, more imports from China or investments in Chinese markets. So there is, you know, a speculation that this is a big part of the shift away from the US dollar. However, I think it's important not to overstate this RMB traded oil and its potential impact on the US dollar. It's you know, as I said, Saudi Arabia hasn't moved away from selling oil in dollars. None of the other Gulf states have done so. These Gulf states continue to hold large dollar surpluses, so they have a stake in the dollar, the position of the dollar. They're heavily invested in US financial markets, in US treasury bonds. So, you know, while it's really important to watch this, and you know, I'm not saying it may not happen that there is eventually this kind of trade in RMB, in oil, but it's not something that has happened, and I don't think it's imminent.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because the Gulf is basically trapped. They can't switch because all their money is in the US, right?
Significant proportion of the Gulf's investments are in US dollar. I mean, as with many countries, in US dollar assets. Yes. There's also the other side to this, of course, is that, you know, the Gulf's relationship with American empire since the post-war period, and particularly since the 1970s, has been very close. US has basically been the military backstop to the monarchies in the Gulf. And that kind of, if you like, regional security architecture, you know, it's this military umbrella provided by the United States, hasn't changed. And it doesn't look like that's going to change anytime soon either.
Yeah, it's really interesting because as much as you talk about the deepening oil ties, it sounds like they can't really do much. That isn't necessarily the shift towards like them being the same type of partner with China that they are with the US. So what you're saying is we should essentially separate these two facts out and understand one as just like a natural economic evolution because of booming oil demand, and the other is a security relationship that hasn't really changed. So the Gulf states then aren't really looking to change that relationship. Like, are they playing a balancing game where they sort of benefit from having both at the same time, but is that becoming more and more tricky for them as they kind of like deepen the economic relationship to maintain that?
I wouldn't say these factors should be separated. But I do think there are definitely tensions that are there. And I think we need to kind of think much more about the Gulf in terms of this question of multipolarity, the question of the potential decline of US power. We need to think about the relationships that are emerging between the Gulf, not just in the oil sector, in finance, in technology, diplomatically. These are, I think, having an impact on this historic relationship that was with the United States. It's just that it's not feasible. It doesn't look at that the United States, that any power can replace what the United States has done and continues to provide for the monarchies in the Gulf, this kind of security guarantee, if you like. So it's a contradictory process. And I do think really we need to think more about the Gulf in this context. And I think it's kind of a missing part of this puzzle of thinking about potential US decline, a more multipolar global economy.
Of course, we have to ask about Palestine in some way because of what's happening right now. Is there any bigger role that you see for the Gulf should be playing? Is there like obstacles, the reasons we should understand why they're not taking certain actions? How do you see the Gulf's positioning on what's happening in Gaza and Palestine?
I mean, I think it's very clear again, and this relates to what we were just talking about in terms of the longstanding connection between the Gulf and US power in the Middle East, the part of the US strategy in the region has been to kind of try to knit together Israel and the Gulf states as a kind of, if you like, two pillars of US power in the Middle East. This is not something that began under Trump. It's something that's been in play for decades. However, what we saw, of course, was the Abraham Accords and the normalization between Israel and Bahrain and the UAE through these Abraham Accords. So this kind of economic and political and diplomatic ties between the Gulf, and I would say this would not have happened without Saudi Arabia's consent. I think that everyone is very clear about that. These ties and this process of normalization between Israel and the Gulf states that predate obviously what's been happening in the current war, I think remain really the barrier, if you like, to any kind of Gulf support of Palestine. You know, the Gulf's alignment with US power, reflected through these alliances with Israel, hasn't changed. So I really, and I think most Palestinians would agree, are extremely skeptical of anything that the Gulf might do beyond rhetorical in terms of supporting Palestine and supporting people of Gaza.
It seems like capitalists are in the process of just destroying the planet and ending humanity. So it's sometimes difficult to be hopeful, but we like to ask people anyway, what keeps you hopeful?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is true in the Middle East as it is true globally, that the movements of people, popular struggles, are what is going to save the planet and save and really chart a way forward. We cannot rely on governments, Western governments or Gulf governments, as a means of halting oil production or dealing with the question of the climate. The problem is fundamental. It's a problem that's connected to capitalism. And I really do think that the kinds of mobilizations that we see globally around anti-capitalist struggles as well as the climate is where we can look towards hope. That's where we need to place our hope for the future. And that I think is true, as I said, in as much in the Middle East as it is in the UK, as it is in Europe, as it is anywhere else in the world.
Yes. Global fight against capitalism.
Yeah, in general, your work is fascinating. So before I let you go, can I just ask you, is there anything we didn't ask you about that you think we're missing? Like, if we want to really understand what's going on with the rise of these NOCs or the Gulf powers and their impacts, like, is there something that I should have asked you?
I mean, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I mean, I would just like to kind of emphasize a point that I made earlier, that we need to think about fossil fuels, and in particular oil, both in what it does for capitalism and why it is so, people talk about fossil capitalism, why we need to think about capitalism and fossil fuels as being inseparably connected. That's one thing. The other thing is, when we're thinking about a commodity like oil, to think about it not just in terms of crude oil and the control of, what's under the ground, but think about what happens to it as it moves, as it gets transformed and refined into other products. Basically, everything around us today is a derivative of oil. The plastics that we see, the clothes that we wear, the synthetic fibers that we wear, these are all oil products. And we need to think about oil in this kind of large perspective, not simply as a struggle about crude oil reserves, which is a lot of how people think about oil in the context of the Middle East. It's about the so-called struggle around oil reserves it's not that. It's actually about the kinds of what happens to oil as it gets transformed, who does that, who controls that process, where it gets sold, and thinking about the industry in that kind of integrated sense is really, really important in terms of the climate change.
This was really, really interesting. Absolutely enjoyed the chapter you wrote, and definitely looking forward to following your work. So thanks. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you so much.
Great. Yeah, my pleasure. Really, really enjoyed the conversation today.